You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're a couple of minutes late getting started, folks, but bear with us. We have a super guest here and a great story, and we're going to get right to it.
Absolutely. Who's our guest tonight?
Our guest tonight is Gail Warden.
Yes, welcome, Gail. We're so excited she's on the phone and she's joining us right now. Hello, Gail.
Hello, nice to see you, hear you.
It's wonderful to hear you. We're just delighted. You're our neighbor, but you're still kind of across town. Delighted to have you with us tonight. Jim is going to go ahead and do a little short intro, and then we're going to get talking. So hold on.
Okay, your voice is going in and out.
Our voice is going in and out? Okay.
Yes. We'll do our best, Sarah.
We're going to do our best.
Okay.
Gail Warden left the cold of the Northeast and moved to amazingly beautiful New Mexico 23 years ago. Other than poetry, her passion is travel, which has taken her to all 50 states and over 40 countries. Her book, Reaching for Air, was named finalist for the best first book of poetry from the Texas Institute of Letters. Her third collection, The Geography of Absence, appeared in October 2022. She will read and discuss her second collection, All the Wild and Holy, A Life of Eunice Williams from 1696 to 1785. This won the Poetry Book Prize from North Street Books. And it's the book we're going to be talking about tonight.
Welcome, Gail.
Welcome.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're delighted. We're just delighted. Well, Jim did a little bit of background for you, but we would love to have you share with our audience a little bit more about yourself and also maybe when a little bit about your writing history.
Okay. Well, as Jim said, I've been living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, exquisitely beautiful state, for 23 years, and I moved here from Massachusetts. I started writing when I was about 9 years old. I had no idea it was poetry, but I guess looking back, I guess it was the best a nine-year-old could do without any direction. I was fortunate enough to have, although I grew up in a very poverty-stricken situation, my parents, who were basically uneducated, gave me a wonderful gift. My mother would read to me out of a book of poems that she had, poems for children. And my father somehow managed to memorize several of Robert Service's poems, and he used to quote those to me. So those rhythms are in my head.
That's
great.
That's fascinating. I know that you had shared that although you had started writing when you thought maybe, you know, around nine, unfortunately, a lot of those poems kind of got lost with moves, I think. Is that right?
Yes, unfortunately, they did. My whole childhood scrapbook, I guess you could call it, got misplaced in a move my parents made. So I don't have any of my early childhood things.
And it seemed like you developed a love for travel. Probably maybe a little bit later in life. I think you've been, where haven't you been, Gail?
Lots of places. It's a big world.
Are there a few on your bucket list that you'd still like to get to?
Well, yes, but I think my traveling days are over. I would go, like to go to Southeast Asia, but I'm not going to get there.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. Well, we're never talking about a course writing poetry. Is there something you'd like to share with us right now, either about travel or growing up?
Well, I could read a couple of poems from my first book, Reaching for Air.
Great.
I'm going to
hold it up to the camera so our watchers see what you're reading from, and go ahead.
Okay. First day. They move in August. The child lugs sheets. Her father and the men heave furniture from the flatbed truck past the chicken wire fence into the house. She sees in distance that does not stop the rising spiral of sand, a snake walking on its tail. The men hurry. Her mother closes windows. Between weathered boards, the child wiggles her fingers. Sand coats cracked linoleum. At dusk, sun lights the strips, the rooms in long strips. She brushes sand from the bed into a bucket, puts on her nightgown, and turns back the sheet. A scorpion crawls out.
Wow. That's so descriptive. I feel like I was right there.
Yeah, that sounds like a personal story. Where was that?
This is on the Hardscrabble Farm.
Okay.
That we moved to when I was 5 years old. It's in West Texas. Not all the way west, but west of Dallas and that area. I could read another one if you like.
Yes, we would. That was excellent.
We'd love to hear you read again.
Okay. The gate. She leans against the gate, places her arms carefully on the rough wood, rests her chin. She clings, her small bottom protruding, her pink dress blowing in the hot breeze. The highway runs in each direction, blending with the blue. She raises one arm to read the indentations in her reddened flesh, arranges the arm in a different position. She strips a sliver, jabs its ragged tip into the board in slow rhythm. In one direction, a dot grows into a car, passes, soon becomes a dot again. She climbs down from the gate and tries, as she does every day, to lift it, to watch it swing open. Her thin arms tremble with the weight, drop to her sides. She could climb over, as many times, knows it is not the same.
Okay.
We're speaking with our special guest, award-winning poet, Gail Loredan, and it's just wonderful that your descriptions in your choice of word choices are so very, very clear and almost painterly. I'm able to see and touch and feel like that little girl did. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's nice. I'm glad you used the word painterly. That's good.
What is it, Gail, that you enjoy about writing poetry and reciting it?
What do I enjoy about it? Starting with a vague idea, a vague memory, a partial sentence I hear someone say, and not knowing where it's going, and I write the first line. And I write by hand. I always write by hand first. And start with the first line, and then where it goes, where it ends up, I'm always surprised. So that's the satisfaction.
You had shared with us that you were at a conference, writer's conference, poetry conference, and you had to write a poem. What was that, a poem a day?
Yes, that was Squaw Valley Writers Conference, and there were four well-known poets who were leading the workshops. It was a week long, and we had to have a new poem every day for 7 days, which kind of shocked me because I'd never written a poem a day. This was back in 91, I think. And so we would get the poems written, and they would pick, somebody would come from the office and pick them up, and by 10 o'clock we would be in our workshop, and the poems would all have been copied, and so everybody had a copy of everybody's poem. That was an amazing experience to do that. Four of the poems ended up in this book, and two were published in journals, and one I threw away. It wasn't worth it.
You know, under that pressure, one a day, but getting, and two of them are in the book, Reaching for Air. How long actually did it take you to put the whole book together, though?
I wrote it over a period of years.
Over a number of years.
Hello?
Yeah.
I can't hear you.
He was just saying, and you answered the question, it took several years to gather the poems together for the collection, right?
Right.
I wasn't aiming
for a collection. I just write what I need to write. Yeah. And then suddenly there's a group that feels like it could be a book.
Yeah. So when you had to do that, the one a day, was there a set time? You said you started the actual conference at 10 in the morning. So you had to be, how much time were you given for that, to write the poem?
Well, there was a lot going on the rest of the day. And for some reason, since this was a Squaw Valley ski resort, there were six of us in the house that I was assigned to. And by the second day, for some reason, our house ended up being the place people gathered at night, in the evenings, sharing poetry and talking poetry and everything. So that was fun. And we had a lot of things to do in the afternoons. So the only time was to get up by about 5 o'clock and go sit out on this little balcony, had one chair and one little tiny table, and look out over the valley to the mountains in the distance and just let something come to me. I had no idea what. So that was, and we had to have the poems ready for the office person to pick up by 7 a.m.
Oh, by 7. Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. I was thinking you started at 7. Oh, it had to be done by, I wouldn't sleep.
It was very active, so one slept pretty well.
Gotcha.
Did Hemingway spend some time in Squaw Valley?
No, he was in
Idaho someplace.
Hold on.
Idaho.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds like quite. So have you, once you sort of learned how to, you developed a little bit of a daily writer's muscle, I think, didn't you? Did you try to continue that type of exercise in your, you know, back when you got back home and you were back to life as usual?
No, because being back to regular life meant I had very little time to write.
Yeah.
I've always had to work.
Sure. Yeah. I get that now. We're going to talk about, so we'd love to just have you already tell us a little bit about what we will be talking about in greater length shortly, All the Wild and Holy, The Life of Eunice Williams. I'm holding it up to the camera, 1696 to 1785. Would you just kind of tell us a little bit about how this full-length poem came to be and maybe a little bit of its backstory? It did win the North Street Book Prize, first place, and congratulations on that. That had to be very exciting.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about this, and then we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to get into it in greater detail.
Okay. I was hired by the local NPR station in Amherst, Massachusetts, to do some research on some topics that they were thinking of writing scripts for. And one of those topics took me to the archival library in Old Deerfield, Massachusetts, which is about 20 miles or so north of the town of Amherst. And While I was researching the assigned topic, I kept coming across this name, Eunice Williams. Eunice Williams, Eunice Williams. Why didn't she return? Why did she choose to stay with the natives, the savages? Why didn't she return? And so once I finished my project for the radio station, I decided finally to go back and try to find out who she was and why there was so much literature written about her in the first, especially the first 200 years after her demise. And what I found was that she was a child of the Puritan, quote, city on the hill. Her mother was related to Cotton Mather, which made her a person of interest and of prestige. So when she wouldn't, when she refused to return, they kept harassing her her whole life. The village where she was living was, her whole family lived, was Deerfield, Massachusetts at that time. And she was awakened on the night of February 29th, 1704, with fire and screams and yelling and musket shots and all kinds of things. And it was a group of so-called Indians who were destroying her village. And they took 112 people, including Eunice, captive. And these were not all Indians. They were mostly French from Montreal, dressed up like Indians, mm-hmm. with a few Indians included.
Mm-hmm. It was it was quite a pivotal moment in history. And for any of us that grew up in New England or had school as young people in New England, which I did in Connecticut, we all learned something about the Deerfield Massacre. And it's, you know, mostly we, as we go older and we go through education, we hear more about what happens in the Midwest and the North, you know, the Northwest and such. And New England kind of falls away in terms of teaching about what went on. This was quite a devastating massacre, and it left, I think there were also 48 that died. Eunice at seven, she goes on to have a very lengthy life and a very interesting life. And when we come back, Gail's going to tell us more about what happened as she is leaves Deerfield and kind of begins a new life, right?
Right. A totally new life.
No more of those buckles on the shoes and that, and those tight clothes up the neck.
That's right.
Stay with us. We're going to take a very short break, tell you a little bit about our Out West Shop bookshop affiliate page, and we'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with our special guest, or Gail Oradin.
Who I often, Gail, want to call you Eunice.
Yeah, I did that several times when Bobby and I talk about the book, you know.
You write in her verse, in her voice so well that I just think that you're Eunice when we're talking about this book. And I'm just holding it up to the camera once again. Jim, do you want to start us off?
Well, there's a little backstory, I think, to this, to the massacre. We obviously, we were tackling the settlement of the Puritans, but to me, it seemed like maybe it was a little bit, it was really the French against the English kind of a deal. Was that part of it?
Well, it was during the time of the French and Indian War. I mean, that's what we call it. I don't know what they call it in Montreal. But it was a struggle for a long time. So it was a part of that. And it was during the time when the French, based in Montreal, were trying to overtake that part of the United States, or what became the United States. Mm-hmm. They were trying to conquer it. And that's what caused the war.
So Eunice is taken, she's captured, along with a couple other family members. Who else is captured that she knew close in her family?
Her father and her brother Stephen, who was about 12 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And her mother and the infant that had just been born didn't get very far because her mother was too weak from childbirth. And the infant was crying and so forth. So anybody who couldn't keep up got killed by the Indians or whoever. You know, the so-called Indians and the Indians, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I don't know who actually did the killing. Nobody does. Yeah.
Right.
You know, we're talking about Puritans. Can you expand on their philosophy a little bit and kind of their teachings? They kind of lived a pretty austere life, best I can tell.
Yeah, they were an extremely austere life, and the role of females of any age was really very poor, which is my whole point about putting this book in Eunice's voice, because when I was doing the research for it over a period of 12 years, it finally dawned on me after a few years of reading hundreds of articles that were written while she was still alive, as well as books and so forth, that they were all written by men. And I said, oh, mm-hmm. we've got to hear from Eunice, you know, because they would say things like, oh, well, she refused to return because she felt her father had abandoned her, and various things like that. But that was a totally male perspective, because the women, of course, the females don't count in Puritan society. Mm-hmm. It was very austere. It was dictatorial. It was an unpleasant time.
Mm-hmm. And things were quite different in her new life, and the way that women were treated and such. You want to share a little bit about the family culture and such, where she goes?
They took the 112 from Old Deerfield and marched them through the winter snow and ice north to Montreal. And she, when they got there, she was given into the hands of a prominent French family, where she spent some unspecified amount of time, I would say at least several months, maybe a year. And then she was taken to southwest of Montreal on the St. Lawrence River to the Caughnawaga Mohawk Reservation, and that's where she stayed the rest of her life. And to this day, people who carry the last name of Williams claim her as their ancestor. People who still live in Caughnawaga. And she was she ultimately became what they call a clan mother. The Navajos have a similar system where the clan mothers are the rulers, and the women in general in the Iroquois Nation make all the decisions. The clan mothers choose, clans are separate groups within a larger tribe. And they make all the decisions. They decide who the chief will be, and they give him instructions as to what to do. So it's definitely a matriarchal society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about that. Now, that's like 100% difference between Eunice's experience with the Puritans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely. Well, why do you think she stayed?
You can see why she wouldn't go back.
The most recent book that I know of that's been written about her was published in, I think, 1995 or so by John Demos, who's a professor of history at, or colonial history at Yale University. So I thought, okay, he's going to give me some information that I don't know about because I know his research extended far beyond what I could do. Yeah. So when he came to town to give a reading from the book, I thought he would say something different from what I had read over that period of 12 years doing research. But no, it was still the father. It was still because what her father did or didn't do or something like that. So he did not give Eunice a voice. So that just convinced me I was on the right track.
You were on the, yes, Eunice found her voice in finding you, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Again, your writing in this book is just visually, you know, I can see it on the big screen. It's just so beautiful and so moving. You're able to move our hearts with so few words, Gail. You're able to get right to the essence of what she's feeling or what she's seeing or, you know, what she's thinking. Is there, I think we would love to hear you share some of Eunice's voice. Is there something you'd like to read now or a few different short pieces? What would you like to do?
Yes, I'll read a few now. Okay. I'll start with the first poem. I am frozen. I cannot move. My eyes do not see what they see. I want to scream and scream with those around me. My mouth opens on silence. They drag us away across the meadows. Those who stumble receive a hatchet stroke. Hepzibah Belding calls out to God as she falls. I will not look at her. I will not. My eyes open to our village, red with flames.
It's great.
You're just right there, aren't
you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember reading that today about three times.
I know. We've been so captivated. We have been reading and rereading, and one of us will say, oh, listen to this, you know, and it's wonderful to hear it also. It's your voice. It's her voice and your voice. Lovely. You have another passage?
Yeah, well, I'll go on. I will skip. Okay. There's about 20 poems about the trek, and then they reach a midpoint, and that's where they stay for 2 or 3 weeks. Today, we reach a clump of bark houses where red people called Abenaki live. Children playing with a hoop and ball stop to look at us. Their fathers must be absent if they can play in mid-afternoon. My Indian hands me to a woman. She says strange words to me and smiles. I am afraid he will leave me here. How will I find my way home? Her Indian is the one that carried her on his back all the way. Mm-hmm. The woman who smiles brings me warm clothes made of soft skins. The pungent smell twitches my nose. Father would have me cut off the fringe and beads as being of heathen nature. Yeah. But my Indian might be angry if I did. The woman speaks long to me, points and smiles at the bright decorations. The moccasins, too, are fringed and come up almost to my knees. But Father has not returned. I am here alone and must decide for myself. Mm-hmm. And then she goes on with this woman, various activities. The woman shows me how to braid strands of eel skin into a rope and sends me out to play with her daughter and my Deerfield friends. I see no books here. The children do not sit for long hours on wooden benches. How do they learn? So she had no concept that she was learning.
Right.
Learning a totally different way. Yeah.
Yeah.
How does she meet her husband?
He was a runner from another tribe. And runners are people, are the men who do errands for the chiefs, and they go places, they transmit messages, that kind of thing. So he came to her village, and that's how they met.
Yeah, we call him a courier, but runner. Runner is good.
Runner
is what Native Americans, even Native Americans today call them runners.
Yeah.
Runners.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Is do you want to read something about them?
About who?
About she and her husband.
I can go to the third section. No, the second section, just a minute.
Oh, did we skip something you wanted to share? I apologize.
No, that's okay. One of the things I did want to say is about her determination, because she was a very intelligent child. Let me just find it a minute. A man in a woman's long black dress comes to talk with me. This is when she's still in Montreal. A gold cross dangles from his neck. Father would call such adornment vanity. The man tells me I must confess. Catholic, that dreaded word, popery, it lives here in Montreal. Yeah. Father and Cousin Mather fear it utmost. Father says we are the city on the hill and all else casts darkness. A man in a woman's dress. Indians in moccasins. The city gates forbid both.
Mm-hmm. That's a good passage.
Yeah.
They were married a long time, weren't they?
They were married a long time.
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
I know.
I want to read.
You're skipping ahead, Jim.
Am I ahead of the game?
You're skipping ahead.
Yeah, you're ahead of the game. I tell you, I still love this book, and I never tire of reading the poems, even though I wrote them.
Of course.
She wasn't the only one to stay. Some of the adults stayed, and the children. This is the poem where I include the children. My Deerfield friends who stay with me here, the Marys first, Mary Carter, Mary Sheldon, Mary Harris, Mary Fields, Elizabeth Mims, Freedom French, Martha French, Rebecca Kellogg, Joanna Kellogg, the boys too, William Brooks, Daniel Crowfoot, Waitstill Warner, Joseph Kellogg. It was interesting that to read about that some of the adults who did return to Deerfield for years, but mostly the rest of their lives, they would go what the Australians call walkabout, or the Australian Aborigines call walkabout.
Mm. Yes.
They would just disappear out into the woods and stay gone for several weeks. They would eventually come back, but they liked what they experienced in terms of their
is that what walkabout means? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that term several times.
Yeah, but yeah, it's where in Australia the Aboriginals will just, one of them will just stand up and take off, and might be gone for weeks, and eventually comes back. I mean, even children, Aboriginal children, will do that. It's a fascinating thing.
Kind of connecting to the wild.
Yes. Well, it's a spiritual connection for them, but that's, you're right, it's the wild.
Yeah, yeah. And I can certainly understand that for those that had lived that kind of life and then come back to the strictness of the colonial New England after having lived an entirely different kind of life. So that makes total sense to me. She had opportunities to be redeemed and chose, and obviously she chose not to.
Yeah, I skipped that section. Do you want me to go back and read from that?
Let me just see what time. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and read from that? We don't want to miss anything.
All right, just a moment. Let me find it.
We're talking with our special guest. Okay,
this is the marriage part. The women in my lodge say my blood has flowed many seasons, and it is past time to wed. I am 15. I will not let him be chosen for me. They say he must be from outside our clan, yet not from Nisqually's husband's house. When I wed, I will own my land and my fire as do other women. And my husband will reside in my house, not his mother's. They cannot make me do otherwise. So she even rebelled to the Native American custom.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does.
We like her.
Yeah. Okay. John Schuyler comes from Albany, I am told, expressly for me. I do not wish to see him. I tire of their pestering and will not speak. Mm-hmm. Two interpreters are needed, they think, English to French, French to Mohawk. He implores, begs, bribes. My beloved family longs for my return. A compromise. I should visit with guarantee of return if I choose. I remember some words, enough. The English treat me as though I have no mind of my own, as though because I do not speak, I am ignorant. My anger burns like hot steel in my breast. They think me stupid, that I do not know the savagery, that I did not see the Deerfield was killed along the march. My own mother fall beneath the hatchet. They think I do not know the savagery, how the English prize an Indian scalp.
Very good.
Where are we?
Well, let's see.
Well,
I have a question. when I was rereading today, the Tree of Peace. What is the Tree of Peace?
It's an Iroquois thing. The Seven Nations of the Iroquois revere the Tree of Peace. It's what our Constitution, it's Native American Iroquois, but it's what our own Constitution comes from. Our own Constitution is based on the Tree of Peace statement.
Yeah. That was so interesting in the poem that you write about the particular tree is uprooted and all of the weapons get planted in a hole and then the tree is replanted over it. And why aren't we doing that today?
Well, the Iroquois people still do it today.
Yeah.
Now we're too busy adding on to our collection of weapons.
We're adding to the collection, exactly.
That changed the subject. What's your time here? You got that one down there and the one up there?
Well, because we started a little bit late. So that's why we have two different times going on.
So you know which one?
Well, I'm thinking that we're just looking at time, Gail, and I know we started a little bit late, but we probably will want to go ahead and move into a little bit about process with you. How did you decide to title the book All the Wild and Holy as the kind of the key words in that title?
Father's voice comes back to me, his speech about subduing the wilderness. Did he not know he subdued the wilderness and me also? But I forget. That was the purpose. Among my people, I breathe deep and spread my arms to embrace all the wild and holy. Mm-hmm. That's just the way I wrote the poem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's the closing, kind of the closing lines of the poem.
Yes. Right.
Did you have some did you encounter some challenges as you had done a lot of research and you didn't start to write, as I recall, till your research, you basically felt like, okay, I've got it. And then were there some challenges in actually finding her voice and then letting those words just flow?
Yes, it took a while to figure out. I mean, I knew it was her, had to be her voice, and I knew all about her, you know, as much as I could. So that's where I started. And I, as far as organizing the sequence of poems, I would put them up on a wall with pink nonstick wall tape and look at them and walk around the room and reading them. And then I would change them. I would put them in different places and so forth. I also did that. I had two residencies at the Virginia Center for Creative Arts, and that's where I did a lot of the work in terms of organizing the poems. Mm-hmm. And that time they were mostly written. Of course, a lot of revision went into it too. Mm-hmm. But that was the challenging part.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite place that you like to be when you're writing?
At home, because it's quiet here.
Yeah,
I don't listen to music or anything else when I'm writing it, because I'm totally focused on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I have to listen to my inner voice in order to know. I mean, that's the way the poem comes out, is by letting it flow from my inner voice.
Mm-hmm.
Any poem I write.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever experience writer's block?
There's no such thing.
Right.
I get tickled when people refer to writer's block. I think, no, you just take a break. You know, you don't have to write every single day. You don't have to write every single minute. You just take a break, and then your inner voice will come back to you.
You've been.
I found the same thing when I was writing my historical fiction novel. I just take a break.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've been writing for a long time. You must have a wonderful tip for a new writer or somebody thinking about becoming a writer. Do you have a great tip to share?
Well, the most important tip, I think, is to be sure to join a supportive style critique group. a lot of critique groups are not supportive. They just knock you down, tear everything apart.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a supportive group of people who help each other improve their poems. I'm very lucky to be in a group. There are six of us right now, and I put just about everything by them, and they make wonderful suggestions.
Mm-hmm. And we met you through Southwest Writers, and they've been so very open to us. We're not writers at all, but we want to understand about the writing process, and we want to get to know all of you that do it. And it's wonderful to belong to a group that encourages that. So that's a great tip. What are you working on next, and where can people find you?
Well, that's two very different things. what I'm working on now is a manuscript that is mostly finished. I'm ready to look for, excuse me, I need some water.
Sure, of course. We're talking with Gail Laura Dunn. She's been our special guest tonight.
What I'm working on now is a manuscript called Consider This. And it's based on the book by Lucretius, a first century BCE philosopher. And the title of this book is On the Nature of Things.
Mm.
So that every poem in the manuscript, you would speak, they're written so you're kind of forced to consider this, whatever this is.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim, I think you have a quote maybe you'd like to
share
from one of the poems, and then we're going to just announce next week's guest, and we're going to say goodnight. So hold on just another moment. Go ahead, Jim.
Reading again like you've been doing from your book. This is from Eunice, and she's on the trail after being captured. At night, my body trembles, although I am warm inside the bearskin blanket. Mother is dead. I know it. She could not keep up. The Indians march swiftly and accept no stragglers. Tears dry inside my head.
And that's...
Thank you, Jim. Thank both of you very much for having me.
We've just been delighted, Gail, that you were able to join us tonight. We've been talking with Gail Loredan and her book, one of the two books tonight, All the Wild and Holy, A Life of Eunice Williams, 1696 to 1785. She does have a Facebook page. And if you would like to reach out to her, or if you would like to reach out to her, you can also do through us, through our Rendezvous with a Writer Out West Facebook page. Yeah. Gail, thank you so very much with us. And thank you to everybody that was with us tonight. Very quickly, we're just going to share that next week, our guest is Carmen Peone. I'm holding up one of the two books we'll be discussing. This is the book Captured Secrets. It's part one of a series, and part two, book two, launches next Tuesday. And she'll be joining us to talk about book one and also book two, Broken Bondage. We really, really thank you all for being with us tonight. Jim?
And from us... It's always a great day out west.
We'll see you next week. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.